This podcast is brought to you by the Legarten Institute. I'm Sian Hansen, Executive Director, and we hope you enjoy this conversation.
Welcome to this special Legarten Institute video, where I am joined today by Jonathan Sacks, Lord Sacks, the former Chief Rabbi here in the United Kingdom, who has just published a book, Not in God's Name, which is about some of the dialogue that he's been having with people of religious faith and looking at some of the violence that has been perpetrated in God's name. And the book is about his challenge to that violence. And I'll talk a little bit about the book in a moment, but Jonathan, thank you so much for being with us today. And the reason you've actually come into Legarten is to talk about the Vision of Capitalism project and why, to a large extent, in the advanced world, capitalism has produced this enormous wealth, but in some sense, many people feel left out. Many people, particularly at the bottom, feel that capitalism has stopped working for them. The gap between the rich and poor has widened, and some people now fear that their children won't be better off than themselves, and that their own lives, they aren't seeing the kind of advance of previous generations. What would you put that down to?
Well, it's clear that capitalism has delivered its fundamental promise. It is the best system we've ever discovered for generating and creating wealth. The end result of which is at least, at the very least, 500 million, perhaps a billion people have been taken out of poverty in the last 20 years, largely in India and China. But wherever capitalism has touched, it's created wealth and taken people out of poverty. And that, has to be said, is a spiritual achievement as well as a material one. Mm. Because as one of our great sages, the 12th century Rabbi Moses Maimonides once said, very hard to have elevated spiritual thoughts if you don't know where your next meal is coming from, if you're racked with poverty or disease. So I see this as a moral, material, and spiritual achievement. But capitalism never was all that good at distributing wealth. We've just had, of course, this bestseller of last year, Thomas Piketty's Capitalism for the 21st Century. But what he's really doing is reminding us what Leviticus chapter 25 told us 3,000 years ago, which is that over time, the market economy generates growing inequalities. And that is particularly so when it comes not so much to wages for labor, but as to the return on capital. Mm. So the Bible obviously worked out this very unusual and very effective system of every 7 years, the sabbatical year, every 50th year, the Jubilee year, of, as it were, creating a level playing ground, not so much by
A lot of
income.
People will be familiar with the Jubilee campaign in the year 2000 for forgiveness of third world debts.
Release of debts, third world debt, which was inspired by Leviticus 25, which of course is proclaimed on the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. So I think we're beginning to realize that every so often, you know, the great force for equality and welfare provisions by the government came, of course, because of the Second World War. And then we had that period in the 80s of Reaganomics, Thatcherism, which, as it were, liberated markets, generated a lot of wealth, but a generation or two down the line, we're now facing those inequalities. They're real, they're serious. Not so much because equality matters. I don't think you're ever going to get full economic equality, but because dignity matters. And that, I think, matters a great deal.
And the economic wealth that capitalism has unleashed, and you're absolutely right, across the world as a whole, this is an extraordinary time of defeating poverty. People like Bill Gates have noted that capitalism, much more than the philanthropy that he is associated with, the foreign aid that government is, that's been what's conquering poverty. In the advanced world, it's slightly more complicated, and part of what we're seeing is greater equality in the world as a whole, but some greater disadvantages. Manual jobs, for example, that used to pay a good wage in places like Britain, that work's now being done in China or Thailand or, or wherever. The left, a lot of people on the right, look always to material solutions to this problem. They blame capitalism entirely for this inequality, but there are books at the moment by Charles Murray and David Brooks on the conservative libertarian side, mm-hmm. books from Robert Putnam on the left of American politics, who's saying actually there's a lack of social capital that partly explains this as well, which is what you were writing about 20 years ago.
Yeah, it was the theme of The Politics of Hope, which was back in early 97. And of course, they have just stayed with it and are now telling us something very interesting indeed, which is one half of America is rebuilding social capital and another half of America is losing it. And you are therefore getting not only an economic divide, but a social divide, an educational divide. You have a half of America that's rebuilt its families, mm-hmm. that is actually going back to church and to synagogue, that is strongly committed to voluntary activity, that is ferociously ambitious for its children. And those kids brought up in those stable homes are going to have a huge advantage over the half of America that have been left behind. And, you know, this was traditionally, if you think about it, what brought the Methodist Church into being. This is a real challenge, not for government, but for the churches, for religious groups, for voluntary work, just to go out there and rebuild families and communities. I think it's an exciting challenge. But first and foremost, it's a psychological phenomenon and a social one. And the consequences are economic, but the economics is not how you change the system.
And if anyone should be telling our politicians not just to see us as taxpayers and welfare claimants and shareholders, but also as parents and neighbours, it should be the church, it should be the synagogue, it should be the mosque, it should be the religious community, shouldn't it?
I think we all have a major role in this. And, you know, I'd be more than happy to work with the secular charities who take that broad humanistic approach. Mm. And historically, it came from both the right and the left of British politics. Historically, you had Edmund Burke talking about the importance of the little platoons. Mm. And at the same time, you had the ethical socialists who were incredibly committed to fellowships, friendly societies, the forerunners of the trade unions.
The Methodism rather than the Marxist side.
That's
of,
right.
Of the left. Yeah.
You know, I heavens above, I love Karl Marx, whose grandfather was a rabbi, but I actually think he got things terribly badly wrong, and I think it really was the Methodists who were more right than Marx.
Switching to this book that you have just produced, a lot of people at the moment think religion is the force for trouble in the world. They switch on their television screens, they see images from the Middle East, and they see violence perpetrated in the name of religion. Politicians scrabbling around to try and find political solutions to what you argue are actually fundamentally false lines within religion, and religious leaders need to say what is going on is not in their name, not in God's name. Tell us why you decided to write this book.
I started writing this book after I wrote a book that was published on the first anniversary of 9/11. I stood at ground zero. I was so traumatized that I wrote a book called The Dignity of Difference, which did actually create a
I remember the controversy at the time, yeah.
And but I was determined that was my first, not my last word on the subject. So ever since 9/11/2002, I've been working on this book, which is a seriously theological book. What happened was that very soon after 9/11, we heard from George W. Bush, from Tony Blair, and from others, that this is not only a war of weapons, it's a battle of ideas. Well, we've seen the weapons, we've seen the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, we haven't seen or heard the ideas. Thus far, the only ideas we've heard are freedom and democracy. Now, freedom and democracy make sense to us. They don't make a whole lot of sense to religious radicals whose highest value is not freedom but submission, and for whom the will of God trumps the will of the people. So these were the wrong words and could not have any positive effect. At the end of the day, if the problem is religion, then religion had better be part of the solution. And that's exactly what I've done here. I've asked the deep questions. What is the connection between violence and religion? What is the connection between violence and monotheism? What is the connection between violence and the Abrahamic monotheisms, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam? So the first part of the book is really excavatory on psychology and social psychology and the roots of human violence and how they translate into religion. And then I ask, okay, now what are we going to do about it? And I deliver a new set of theological ideas, or in fact, a new way of reading the critical texts that form the basis of the self-definition of Jews, Christians, and Muslims. They're all narratives of sibling rivalry, and they're all to be found in the book of Genesis. So I've gone back. I mean, Paul refers to them, the Quran refers to them. They are absolutely key to the way Jews, Muslims, and Christians see themselves. And I've gone back and asked the innocent question, have we been reading those narratives correctly for the last several thousand years? And I argue that we haven't. We haven't read them correctly because we've read them on the surface. But if you go just a little bit beneath the surface, and especially if you listen carefully to the stories in the original Hebrew, you'll see that they contain a depth narrative which is radically at odds with the surface narrative. They are actually the Bible's battle against sibling rivalry. So I've tried to deliver a theology for the 21st century that might just speak to Jews and Christians and Muslims. My view is that the moderates in all three faiths are going to have to stand together if we are to defeat what is one of the most dangerous movements that we've seen in a very long time. Because it doesn't matter whether we call it Al-Qaeda or Boko Haram or ISIS, all of which could go out of existence very rapidly. The phenomenon that lies beneath all of those and others is very deep-seated, and a whole lot of factors, like the information technology revolution, have come together to create the perfect storm. Something we haven't seen in Europe since the 16th and 17th centuries. So we are at a really serious moment of history, and we are going to have to stand together if we're going to get through safely to the other side.
Well, people that would like to read the book In God's Name by Jonathan Sacks, it's published by Hodder and Stoughton. All it leaves me to say is thank you for briefly sharing your thoughts with us today. Lord Sacks, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
To hear more podcasts from the Legatum Institute, please visit our iTunes channel or website at www.li.com.